Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 15th, 2022, and welcome to episode 255 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and all the bits in a row. I am Paul Hagstrom near Boston. I am joined today by three retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom is Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Excellent. And also we have Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm near Portland, actually.
Near Portland?
Like you're near okay. Boston. But that doesn't matter, does it? Also, my computer is going haywire today, and that doesn't matter either, but it will explain why I might suddenly drop from the recording here. If I do, I'll come back. You can't get rid of me that easy.
Excellent.
And the weather here is rainy, and the internets here are bad, but I'm here happy to talk about all the ones being on 255.
Excellent. Yeah. And here it is suddenly very hot. And unpleasant, but summer has arrived. And lastly, joining us is Blake Patterson in Northern Virginia, near Northern Virginia.
Yes.
I don't know.
I'm in Northern Virginia. I'm near DC, but okay. You know, I don't like to play that game. You know, I'm in DC. You know, I'm in Portland. No, in Boston. No, I keep it real. So, yes, I'm okay. In Northern Virginia, and it is very suddenly hot, very much like near Boston, I think. And I have. I'll say the other thing we're saying is that I have two very clean cars. My wife and I. Twice today went and had our car washed, each at my daughter's fundraising high school car wash. So I've had a twice washed car, and my wife has had a twice washed car. So there is some, I can tell the glint coming in off through the window off this hood of my wife's white Fusion is distracting to a degree. But yes, it's a nice day for a car wash. Very sunny.
Excellent.
Very muggy. So
excellent. Well, okay, so we made it to episode 255, and we thought this would be good. It would be a good idea to make it very special and celebrate in various ways. And then, you know, here we are. It's already the recording day. So, but it's the last of the 8-bit numbers. So, it's sort of impressive. I think we were going to talk a little bit about the byte and the 8-bitness of it and that sort of stuff, and also. Possibly 1955, because we have been following that path as well. Who knows what's going to happen first?
We're going to have to turn our Apple IIe's to 2GS's and our Commodore 64's to Amigas, maybe, to take on the bigger numbers. Yeah, indeed.
An important question was asked in the chat. Did we start with episode 0? I think we did not. So we still have one more.
No, we didn't. We started with episode 1. And I think next one we should call episode 0 informally. I don't think we should do that formally because it'll mess people up on the podcast feed. But I think next time should be episode 0 because we roll over and we'll need a carry bit. But that's okay because Carrying Ton will be with us.
Yes, there you go. We have a Carrying Ton bit.
I find it almost impossible to believe that I wasn't here for it, certainly, all those years ago, but I find it almost impossible to believe that a bunch of, computer Retro Geeks did not start with episode zero, but instead started with episode one. But I find that almost absolutely hard. I can't get my head around that. Are you sure it was episode one?
Pretty sure. So, now, I did start another podcast, Next Without Four, on episode zero, because it's a programming podcast, and I figured they'll never forgive me if I don't do that.
Yeah. I'm surprised and a little disappointed, I guess, to have learned that episode one. Oh, well.
I guess we could start over.
Yeah, as well.
Re-record every single episode. Yeah, it could be like the director's cut. Or maybe we could have running commentary.
Shot for shot remake.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So we have these two sort of split themes, but maybe we can talk first about the bite. And Earl did a little bit of research a while ago, looking at sort of the origin of the term and that kind of thing. Do you remember what you found out?
Sure. I didn't reach a conclusion, sadly, about why we use 8 bits, but there are some theories. So here's what I started out with, was the question, why 8 bits? Why not 6 bits or 10 bits or 36 bits? Because in the early days, computers had a lot of different word lengths. The mainframes of ye old had things like, I think like the DEC System 10 had a 36-bit word length. All of our favorite computers from 75 on were 8-bit computers until the 16-bit computers hit the scene. And I was just curious, why is that? And while there's no definitive conclusion, I think, that I came to from the research, the anecdotal evidence points to you need 8 bits to represent a character. And the encoding schemes of the day, like ASCII, were 7 bits. But if you wanted to get some extended characters in there, you would need another bit to have 256 different possibilities. And 8 is a power of 2. And there is a lot of advantage to that. So having 7 bits or 9 bits or 10 bits or something like that would have been weird. And it wouldn't have been a number that you could have represented as a power of 2. So ultimately, that seems to be where the byte came from and seems to be the design decision that went into the 8-bit processors and 8-bit computers. And if you look at it, like the 4004, I believe, was a 4-bit computer, and then their next step, the 8008, was an 8-bit computer. So they basically ditched everything in between, 5, 6, 7, went straight to 8, and that must have, again, been because it was a power of 2, and an even number that's easy to wrap your head around. So it just seems like it was a practical choice. The term byte was coined in the 50s, seems like. I think in our show notes we had 1956. Is that right, Paul?
I think that, yeah, I did actually have that down. Some history site somewhere said Werner Buchholz coined the term, but I bet that's disputed.
Maybe. And yeah, we've got all the other terms like bit and nibble and byte and word and different ways to represent grouping of bits, but 8 bits is super important for us because the processors like the 6502 and the 6800 and the Z80 and all those, the 8080 were 8-bit processors. And so, of course, that's an entire generation of computing that tends to be a huge part of our focus on RCR. So I just think it's time for a celebration that we hit 255 and we filled up all the bits. But I wasn't able to find out why processors were 8 bits definitively. I actually even thought about emailing a couple of the people who were the main designers of the processors back then, like Bill Mensch or Federico Fagin, to see if anybody would respond to my email and say, hey, why did you do 8 bits? They probably would have said, well, I don't know, what would you have picked? So I don't know if I, or, you know, maybe I would have actually got a coherent, like really interesting academic answer, but, I didn't send those emails. So I guess we'll never know. That'll be Schrodinger's response, but 8 bits is cool though. There you go. That's my bit.
So my understanding is that by the time we got to the consumer-grade processors like the 6502, the 8-bit data word was already pretty well established. You know, a lot of the earlier, especially the mini computers that were weird word lengths, 9, 10, 11, 12 bits, they were usually just an 8-bit data word with parity and checksum bits added. So a lot of those extra bits weren't actually data because early memory was unreliable and they were concerned about, you know, being able to restore data properly. So I think that's, we were kind of closing in on 8 bits probably for 20 or 30 years before we landed on that. And I think probably what solidified it was early TTL chip packages. Once, you know, if you've got 16 pins, let's say, on a chip, 8 bits is a nice fit for that because you've got 8 data input or output bits, and then you've got power and VCC and a couple other maintenance things that you need. You need a select line and you need a, you know, a this or a that. And it just works out really well that by the time you get all of the control signals and the power and ground and everything out of the way, you're always left with 8 pins. And so I think that's probably another factor that kind of solidified it, was just that basic integration that started with TTL. Because a lot of the weird word length computers, the 36-bit and stuff, those were all like transistor, you know, discrete logic types of machines that were kind of the wild west of ALU design back then. And I mean, we were always going to land on a power of two, because if you're building, you know, when you're building an ALU, you start with half adders and then you cascade those up to create full adders, and then from there you get into registers, and it basically has to be a power of two or nothing really works out properly. So I think that's probably how we landed on 8 bits, because it's the smallest power of two that's the least bit useful. You know, 4 bits is not really useful unless you're just making a calculator. You can kind of get away with it, but you know, once, as soon as you get 8 bits, it's kind of a magic number where, okay, we've got a usable range of integers now for most things. So it was probably kind of inevitable, I would guess, on why we landed here.
That's a really good point. The digital logic engineering down at the under the hood level on the CPUs, it's not just that it is mentally handy to have a power of two, it's actually practically handy when you start working down at the gate level with the CPU components. Yeah, that's an excellent observation.
I had seen something that suggested that does make sense, that there is a real logic behind it. What I had gotten, maybe it might be from Wikipedia, but was that basically the IBM System 360 adopted it and everybody followed suit. But that may be why they adopted it too.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, was it the System 360? I think we discussed here a few months ago. I think we discussed here how it is that 80 by, you know, 24, 80 by 25 became a standard display. And I think, again, it was a case of, I mean, 80 had a certain practicality in it before computing, but I think, you know, once it was an IBM, one of their terminal protocols, I think, picked it up, everyone followed it. And so I guess similar sort of thing. And that makes sense, really.
So is EBCDIC an 8-bit code or is it a 7-bit code? ASCII is a 7-bit code, but I don't remember about EBCDIC.
EBCDIC is 7-bit also, I believe, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think they were both created as 7-bit standards because they were using the extra bit for a checksum. People in the early days were very worried about losing data. I guess the hardware was unreliable. So in the early days, everything had checksums and parity bits on it. And we gradually, over the years, dropped that once we realized that, okay, you can put memory in RAM and it's still going to be there 100 milliseconds later.
Yeah, I know that Infocom... You know, I remember being impressed by Infocom that, you know, how they could manage to get so much story and text and prose and stuff on a disk, which is basically, you know, it's actually fairly simple. They just said, all right, well, you only need 5 of these bits to represent a character, so we will just, you know, we'll lose sync with the edges of the bytes and just represent all the characters in 5 bits. And
oh, really?
Yeah. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. Interesting.
So. And that's why they're, you know, at least the early ones are all uppercase, and, you know, because once you commit to that, you don't get lowercase anymore. In the chat end of the line, Joel has mentioned a few things, reminding us that the word byte itself is not definitionally 8 bits. It is, I guess it's some just like unit of information or something, but octet would be the definitive 8 bits name.
That's interesting. But, I have not heard byte referred to as anything but 8 bits. The term word, however, is all over the place. Like, you know, word meaning the small, is supposed to mean the smallest. Well, people don't even agree on the definition, but I think the most agreed upon definition is the smallest integer of the machine, which is usually, you know, 8 bits at the day, but nowadays it's 16 or 32. But again, nobody really agrees on the definition of it.
And for some reason, you hear the term octet a lot in the networking world. Like for the components of an IP address, you usually don't call those bytes.
Oh, yeah.
Usually network folks will call them octets for whatever reason. I guess because it's precise and you know you're talking about 8 bits exactly.
It is interesting that I don't think I was ever really conscious of byte being anything other than 8 bits. But Nibble, however, there was a sort of extended and weirdly heated discussion on the Apple II Slack workspace about what nibbles are, which is also sort of interesting. I don't know. So I guess in my mind, the nibble is the half a byte, right, generally. So I hold that belief. But I also hold the belief that the things on an Apple II disk that represent the data on it, which is not, it's not actually faithful for complicated reasons, which maybe I will say, those things are nibbles too. So and certainly beneath Apple DOS, this like reference tome of the Apple II disk operations refers to them as nibbles. And even in, I think, some source code and stuff, there are nibblization routines and things, you know, in the documentation, so that you know, we know that people at Apple thought of these things as nibbles, but they're not. They're not 4 bits exactly. They can represent something more like 64. There's something like 64 of them.
That always confused me a little bit, and it didn't seem to be limited to the Apple world. When you talk about precision diskette copiers, like things that could get around copy protection, or things that made a copy of a diskette with higher fidelity, they would call them nibblers or nibble copies. And I wasn't sure why that was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like the word nibble got adopted by various domains to mean something smaller than a byte. I mean, we think of it as being half a byte, but yeah, definitely floppy disk people adopted a weirder version of that word. And the most important elephant in the room to me is, why did the Y spelling of byte catch on, but the Y spelling of nibble did not? I think that's a scandal that people are not right. talking enough about.
The elephant in the room.
I tried to make the Y spelling of nibble happen for a few years, but nobody was interested. I submitted an article to JuiceJS using the Y spelling of nibble, and editor Ken gently corrected me on that. That was not their editorial policy, and I respect that. But I'm still going to make it happen one of these days.
I think Earl, what you and Quinn both are saying. I think nibble, like, you know, I guess you're making a disk copier, because I remember nibble copiers, nibble editors. I used to have a great arsenal of Apple II, you know, copy disks, and probably 50, 80, you know, copy programs. And I think a lot of them definitely employed they would call it like half track. You know, copying, because I know that sometimes when people would write the software and master them, like, there would be data on that wasn't on a full track. Like, was part of a track was used, and if the other track had data, it was, you know, a copy protection tool to determine if anything was on that. Maybe nibble being half of a byte, as far as most people knew, maybe half track nibble, you know, maybe that loosely got connected. I don't know. I just do remember a lot of the half track, and the got things copied depending on how the protection worked.
I mean, I do think that nibble was kind of a retcon, right? Like, the word byte had been established for, you know, 30 years or something, and then someone wanted a name for something shorter than that. So it's sort of an engineer joke. Oh, we'll call it a nibble because it's less than a byte. You know, that's pretty clearly what happened there.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever meaningfully use the term nibble in the capacity that we're discussing. Yeah, I don't think, oh, it's only a nibble of information. You know, I don't think I've ever used that. But
I mean, you use it a little bit when you're like programming 6502 or something. Occasionally, you know, you manipulate 4 bits at a time, especially like an Apple II high res and things like that. So it's sort of a, you know, you might see it at comments and source code and stuff referring to Nibbles, but otherwise, yeah, I don't. Yeah, low res, sorry, yeah, low res in a text page.
And, oh, yeah, you mentioned the 6502, and I think the BCD mode on there uses one nibble each digits.
Yeah, the, I don't know if this is going to be a good idea, but the reason that nibble copiers are called nibble copiers is that the on the disk 2, basically, you can't just write bytes to the disk, because if you have more than two consecutive zeros, then the disk can't read it. Like the circuit in there flips out and gets upset that it hasn't seen a one for a while. So you have to, you can use only the bytes that have that don't have more than two consecutive zeros in them. So it's, there's sort of like a mapping between these sort of special special bytes that have the property that you can write and read them reliably to you know, the actual 256 values that you want to represent. So every sector, every 256 byte sector on a disk actually takes something like 340 some of these like encoded bytes, but so they're not really full bytes. They're less information than a byte would have. So, and they're often referred to as nibbles, because that's basically what the, you know, what you get when you read them in off the disk. Oh, actually, the other thing that you the other constraint is that the high bit has to be on. So, even, you know, it's even less than that. You only had 7 bits to work with to begin with, and then you can't have more than two consecutive zeros. So anyway, that's what nibble copiers are. Just basically, they're reading this raw data off the disk without translating it back into the bytes, and then trying to rewrite those back out to disks, hoping that they will get around whatever copy protection involved them.
Good to know. I didn't have that detail.
What else 255 like did we want to talk about?
255. I was looking, I went on eBay to try to find something that might be listed at exactly $255. You know, I couldn't find that. And I was trying to see if there was anything I had, like, you know, my collection of magazines, if I had 255 of, like, Retro Gamer or something like that. I couldn't quite come across it. But it's interesting, I guess, as far as, you know, talking about 8 bits and the bytes, I guess it makes me think of some of the discussions I've had, and I haven't done, you know, I've done some assembly programming on, you know, 6502 and the, I guess, 8088 basic, you know, 8-bit, or, you know, I guess 8-bit. But it's interesting when, you know, you're describing and looking at accelerators and memory for some of these sort of hybrid machines, hybrid in that internal versus external for economical reasons. You know, the Apple IIgs is a 8/16-bit. The 65C816 is an 8/16-bit processor, and that it has, you know, some 16-bit registers, but the data bus is 8 bits. It can only get data in and out. And the Amiga is a 1632, which means it has, you know, it does have 32-bit registers, but, you know, it can only get data in and out at 16 bits at a time. And I've just gotten into some interesting discussions looking at, you know, architectures, comparing them when you hit these particular, you know, types of processors. And there weren't many, you know, it's like evolutionarily, sadly the 816 didn't go any further, but, you know, the 68,000 did. And I guess that had me thinking, when I think about bytes, that's one of the more, you get in discussions on the forums about, oh, you know, like I've added this type of memory. Is it, what, you know, is this 16-bit memory or is it, you know, 8-bit? You can sometimes go both ways, and depending, it'll, if you're in one mode or the other mode, it can or can't take advantage. So anyway, it made me think of that interesting aspect of some of the transitional early machines, 68,000, 65C816. So, you know, when we're talking about bit length and bytes, I think, I've gotten in a great many discussions. I actually wrote a piece, letter to the editor to I mentioned Retro Gamer magazine for some reason. I guess they're the most visually stand out on my shelves in the room here, and about that. And it was they ran it because it's an interesting piece that people, I think, don't really fully understand. But anyway, so that kind of came into mind with this maybe a little bit of an odd odd link. But yeah, I'm still as we talk here, I'm going to still try to see if I can find 255 of anything in this room, and then I'll report on it. But
yeah, the TI-99 was another odd duck in that regard. It had a 16-bit CPU that was sitting on. Yeah, it was sitting on two different buses, one of which was 16 and one of which was 8-bit, and there was some very strange things in that architecture. They really, really wanted to use that CPU, but then it wasn't a good fit for all the supporting chips, so they had to do some pretty strange things to make it all work. Another odd duck that I like is the 68008. It's a version of the 68000 that has an 8-bit bus, and it actually takes the 16-bit bus and just cycles it out over two clock cycles. So it's a way to get a full power 68000 in a very simple architecture. I think they were targeting like microcontroller type applications for it. But it's actually a great chip for hobbyists, because if you want to build a homebrew computer, a 16-bit bus is a lot. Like, it's a lot of wires, and you need twice as many chips for all your address decoding and everything. But if you have an 8-bit bus, you can stick a 68008 on it, and it solves a lot of those problems for you. So that's kind of a neat chip, too.
That's interesting. Yeah, the one of the systems I really would like to have to play with, obscure, you're probably aware of the Sinclair QL. It's a ZX Spectrum, sort of a bigger machine from the same crew. And yes, it has the 68008 as its processor, and it actually has two interesting little wafer tape drives, those kind of stream, those looped, little looping.
Yeah, those tape loops. Yeah.
Yeah, that were such a great idea to fall apart and not. Yeah, that was they were cool, but kind of a strange technology. Yes, and that's just incidentally, I recall that Linus Torvalds got his start on the QL. Like, he was a Sinclair QL guy, and then that kind of sprang into how we got Linux. But the TI was my first computer, and just all the architecture you mentioned is so crazy, and basically no real registers on the chip. It has 256 bytes of 16-bit RAM. The rest is like several buses away, as you say. It's 8-bit, and it's not even next door. I think you have to actually ask the graphics processor to pass you memory, because only the graphics processor can read the RAM that the CPU needs. It's such a weird thing. Apparently a shrunken down version of one of their mini computers, and that's kind of why I guess it's so odd. I recall the memory was used instead of registers in the name of efficiency for time sharing, but of course the TI was not a TI-99 was not a time sharing system, so you didn't gain anything by storing your data in fast memory. So yeah, interesting.
My understanding is that they developed that CPU for much more grandiose purposes, but then TI was kind of fumbling around and they wanted to make a home computer, and they had this CPU sitting there in another department, so they were like, oh, let's just use that. And it wasn't really a good fit for what they were
Heard that there was I think in some part of TI there was a plan to have an 8-bit processor, that was sort of in development. I don't know if it was specifically for the TI, but it would have been a much better fit. But it wasn't, it wasn't available, it wasn't finished at that time. I don't know if it ever came about,
I don't think it did. The project got canceled.
TI, that's quite an interesting piece of history, the way that whole thing went up and down. But very, very interesting first computer to own, I can say, remembering some of those issues as they happened when I was first into it. I'm surprised I didn't go kind of running away, but I didn't. So
the other thing I want to call out about the 68008 for hobbyists is that, and this is calling back to a couple of episodes ago, you guys were talking about 68000 assembly and how nobody had done any of it or even considered doing it. And I have to take issue with that and come on the show specifically for this reason. So one of the other reasons that the 68008 is a great hobbyist CPU is that the 68000 has probably, in my humble opinion, the greatest assembly language on any chip. It really is. It's a fantastic assembly language, and it was kind of the height of CISC chip development, right? So like CISC CPUs complex instruction set computers were designed for humans to write the assembly language. So there's a crazy instruction for everything you want to do. Like, oh, I want to take four 16-bit words and flip them end-to-end and move them to this other memory bank while adding six to them. There's an instruction for that. Like, so compared to, you know, RISC chips are designed for compilers. And, you know, it's like, oh, let's make it an unintelligible assembly language that's really efficient because the compiler is going to worry about writing it. And so the 68000 is the opposite of that. And it's really a beautiful assembly language. It's so nice. There's so many registers. There's an instruction for everything you want to do. So yeah, if anyone is scared away from it because it's a quote-unquote modern chip, I would strongly encourage to give it a try.
Excellent. Yeah, that definitely goes against what I had thought. And what I had thought was not based on any actual experience. It just seemed like there are too many registers. I'm done with this.
Interestingly, in the 68000 world, there's huge efficiency gains for writing assembly by hand because the instruction set is so complicated. Compilers were really bad at it. So 68000 compilers are all really inefficient. They end up using like 10% of the instruction set because it's just too hard to write a compiler that can use all these ridiculous instructions. So it's pretty easy to beat the compiler on performance compared to like a modern RISC chip. You're not going to beat the compiler. Like, it's just, it's not worth the effort for the most part to try and hand write assembly, you know, on something like an x86 or, you know, a modern ARM or something like that. There's just no point. But yeah, on a 68000, absolutely you can beat the compiler. So it's a good exercise for that as well.
I recall, I actually know a number of people who, you know, back towards like the late 80s were, early 90s were, you know, doing some programming for fun, you know, demo sort of things, not really hardcore demo scene things, but I just remember hearing from them how, in their opinion, it was such a heavenly thing. Like, it was such a, like, the 68000 was such a perfect assembly language tool. And I know, I guess, as regards the demo scene, of which I'm a huge fan and have been for decades, you know, I guess I've come across and on the show, I've many different books, you know, that have been written about the demo scene, you know, different groups that talk about the programming. And of course, a lot of it, you know, was on the Amiga, the Atari ST, which was 68000. I keep hearing how nice it is, you know, the 68000 is to program. Whatever I've been exposed to has not been of you know, I don't think I was on the episode where that was being discussed, but I haven't heard much negative about it. So I always kind of regret having not, you know, actually spent any real time other than, you know, an hour or two trying to do anything with, 68000 assembly. I think I started out trying a bit on the Amiga, but I think the complexity of the Amiga system kind of pushed me away. But that wasn't to do with the 68000. That was more to do with, you know, setting up various chips on the board. Makes me want to try to, you know, maybe get an emulator and try the Atari ST as a starting point. It's a much simpler system, but I'm sure it would be a fun endeavor to try that out at some point.
Yeah, that is one of the things that, you know, I think fondly about programming the 6502, but I think you're right that part of that has to do with the environment it's sitting in. You know, like, it's very easy to make things appear on the screen and move around and stuff like that. And I don't have to think about, you know, menu managers or any of the other kind of stuff that I might otherwise need to. So
For a lot of people, that's the appeal of retro console development. Like, if you want to write 65816 assembly, for example, which is also a very nice assembly language because it's got all the charm and warm fuzzies of 6502, but it eliminates all the annoyances, like you get 16-bit index registers and, you know, very, very nice things like that. But if you want to program in that, you're stuck with the Apple II GS, which is a pretty complicated environment, honestly, and not a huge amount of fun to get started in. So a lot of people go to the Super Nintendo instead, because there you're just talking straight to, you know, a sprite tile renderer, and you don't have to worry about an operating system or anything like that. So that's, yeah, for a lot of people, the simplicity of that environment is a lot of it. So if you want to write 68000 assembly, try a Genesis emulator instead.
All right. That's probably good enough, right? Maybe we can move on from that. We have a couple of listener feedback things, and I think also some of our items of interest are also lifted from listener feedback things, but I will mention a couple. So Greg wrote in over email to talk about the sort of process of putting together boxes for software. And so Carrington had mentioned that, I think, couple times ago, one or two times ago, for this adventure game that he's putting together. You know, he's been gathering feelies to put in the box and trying to make the box and stuff like that. And I guess he was saying, I forget exactly what the context was, but we were talking a little bit about how boxes are hard to get in sort of non-standard sizes and things like this. And so Greg wrote to point out a video on the history of the big boxes, you know, like video game boxes. The video is called Big Boxes, and it is it is really just sort of a historical overview. I did not know that big box actually was, that has a very specific meaning. There's a particular size of box that is a big box.
I did not know that either. No,
I do wonder if it's true, but anyway, on the screen we have now, there was a little, you know, showed what the dimensions were of the big box, but it is actually a pretty interesting video, kind of going through the packaging decisions that were made, and how a lot of producers of software eventually landed on a consistent size, so that things all kind of look the same on their shelves and your shelves. And then after that, there was a little bit of divergence. So what's actually on the screen right now is a demonstration of what happened after the divergence, where things no longer fit nicely on shelves.
So that must have been like a 90s PC thing where they settled on a box size for a little while, because prior to that, like the 80s were all over the place.
Right.
Like EA was doing their record folio things and Infocom was doing plastic flying saucers. Like it was chaos.
Yeah. I do think that this is the consistent size box is one from an era that I wasn't participating in very much.
Yeah, I think that's why this is news to all of us, because none of us were 90s DOS gamers, especially.
Yeah.
Well, and I wonder if some of this nomenclature, I mean, if I watched the video, I might know this answer, but there are collectors now who probably want to categorize these things in a way that makes sense to them, like a lot of the other retro stuff that we talk about. So maybe big box, quote unquote, has a canonical meaning for them, but they're collecting
these.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Yeah, it's probably a retroactive categorization of the era. Yeah.
Mm. And I think probably there was a huge sort of early 90s PC game market.
Oh yeah.
And I could imagine that all of those had the same size box.
Well, and I think that there was also a movement there for a while where the bigger the box was, the higher quality or the better the game was perceived to be. And I think that's a little bit of the legacy of the late 80s, where the manuals got thicker and thicker and the feelies kept getting more and more elaborate. You look at games like Auto Duel and Knights of Legend, you know, the late 80s origin stuff, where there was a phone book manual in the box. And I mean, we used to buy games when I was a teenager based on how heavy the box was, right? Because that meant there was a lot of good stuff in there. And I think that probably carried over into the early 90s PC stuff, where if the box was huge, it must be good. But then they were putting less and less stuff in the boxes. I mean, towards the end there, it was just like an index card and a CD. And so I certainly remember a lot of that PC software just being a big empty box.
Yeah. Well, in the in the video, there's some discussion about how, like, when things went 16-bit, the boxes got bigger, you know, because it's that same kind of thing. You know, it was supposed to sort of seem like it was better value.
You gotta fit all the bits in there.
I remember when I was, I guess it was late 80s more than early 90s, buying, you know, games for, and I bought a decent number of games for, you know, the Amiga and the Atari ST. And I remember, like, there were certain companies that you really, like, the boxes were so substantial as far as, like, their ruggedness. And, you know, they had a nice glossy, you know, shrink wrap on the, you know, for instance, what we're looking at there, for those watching the stream, is there's a picture of Psygnosis's boxes. And one of the companies was Psygnosis. And they would have, their boxes were just the highest quality, and they were strong. Like, you could actually, you know, set a television on one. And another company was Firebird or Rainbird, you know, the Starglider company, the Pawn, things like that. That's the, I remember the box, we used to talk about it, you know, like how cool the boxes were. And
yeah, they're nice and blue.
Yeah, those were nice. Those were nice and blue, and they all had that nice liftoff. Like, they weren't, you didn't pull a flimsy piece of cardboard, you know, like opening it at the top. It was, you know, you take the actual shrink wrap off, and the whole thing would lift off. You know, you would have the whole front would lift off, and it was nice and tight. You'd have to really try, because the vacuum, you know, the air vacuum, it didn't want to give. Just real high quality. I remember. Right. You know, I may or may not have, you know, bought every game I played back in the day, but there were some games I bought. The thing that pushed me over was the box, and that's between Psygnosis and Firebird. So it certainly wasn't a worthless detail, you know, I think.
It's important to collectors. I mean, I watched a couple of videos on RMC, that YouTube channel, where Neil was working with some other folks to figure out, how do I restore this box? I've got all these boxes from back in the day, and some of them are more beat up than others, but I'd like to bring them back to their former glory. It was really interesting, actually, watching some of the techniques of reanimating these things, especially the more beat up ones. The results were great. I was very impressed with the some of the techniques of bringing these things back to their glory.
That's interesting. There must be a whole scene, well, some sort of a scene out there for that. I kind of wish that I could see enjoying the collecting of boxes, but I did mentally draw the line there, because I, you know, it's just like, these are large containers of air that are designed to take up space. And so, like, I actually...
the space thing.
Yeah. I held on to a lot of the boxes for some of the computers that I had acquired from eBay. You know, I had... You know, certain Amiga boxes and Atari boxes, but they just ended up taking up so much space that, very sadly, I mean, I could have sold them, but I kept a few. I took a photograph of everything, but I did throw them away, you know, because it just wasn't the space. And I guess I should have done something more preserving of them. But yeah, I try to stay away from boxes, even though it would be nice. They just, it's like they're roping off air. Spaces, you know, space for other things, and it makes me sad that that's the case. But
they were an important, you know, marketing tool at the time. I mean, it's easy to forget now that there was no trailers or YouTube videos about a game where you could decide if it was going to be for you or not. So you know, especially as a teenager, you're standing in this computer store looking at a row of boxes. You're making your decision based on these cardboard boxes. So if there's one box that's obviously higher quality, it's got cool artwork, it's, you know, it's physically larger. That's going to definitely influence your decision. Like you were saying, Blake, you can always tell the, like, chintzy boxes, the ones where it just opens, like, the top short end of it opens and the cardboard's flimsy, and in comparison to the, like, board game quality, like,
right,
lift off the lid air suction boxes. Like, I mean, absolutely that influenced, you know, certainly my buying decisions.
Yeah, no, it felt, you'd get home. I mean, remember the feeling. You'd get home, you'd tear off the thing, and you'd lift it, and you would feel, you know what, sounds like you know what I'm talking about, that air suction thing, you know, and it slowly drops down, and then you're like, wow. And that's something that people don't really have anymore, don't get to experience anymore. But
and like Jeremy says in the stream comments here, and they all had the Amiga screenshots on the box. So if you're going and you're buying a Commodore or an Apple II game, you don't even know what it looks like, because on the back of the box, they're going to have the Amiga screenshots. And so you're literally buying it based on how heavy the box is or the quality of the artwork on the box, which is a little silly.
One thing that's kind of funny, though, is that, you know, even with modern things that are, you know, that live only digitally, they're delivered to you by download and all that stuff, often people will do a box mock-up, you know, on their sales site. You will be able to see as if it had a box.
A virtual box, if you will.
It's like how they still do album artwork for albums, but there's no albums anymore, so they just have this little square of artwork that they try to put wherever they can on the website and various other places.
It is always kind of sad, the actual 12-inch square record size, you know, for art was quite nice, and it was always annoying when that art got shrunk down to CD size, and it's even more annoying when it's this little tiny thing in your iTunes and you can't enlarge it.
Yeah.
All right. The next feedback thing. I don't know, Quinn, if you saw this, but many years ago, in what was it, November 2014, Joshua had submitted a story to an epic episode of Open Apple. It was a 3-hour episode of Open Apple, and somewhere in there was Joshua talking about sort of an update on sort of recovering a lost scenario from the Traveler role-playing game. Does anyone know here that game, Traveler?
I know the game, yeah. It's a very old paper RPG from like the early 80s, late 70s, something like that.
Yeah. The information I have is that it's a, you know, tabletop RPG from 1977, and M apparently knew it very well. You know, it was like, it was, you know, a favorite.
But, yeah, it was popular. A lot of people play it. I think people still play it. Like, it's, yeah, it was a pretty big one.
Yeah. But so back, the story basically back at the time had been that someone had basically written a module for it. It was called Manhunt, and it was sent off to the publisher to, you know, sort of be produced, but then the publisher dropped the series. You know, so this was considered to be kind of like a lost scenario. And then in 2014, the guy who wrote it, Philip Athens, found a box of old floppy disks, and on it were the magic window files of the, you know, like the scenario. And so
I remember this now. Yeah, this was, we talked to Randy Brandt about this. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. I remember that. I remember this. Yeah.
So, and you know, I mean, essentially the story was just that, through use of ADT Pro and, you know, a few people helping out, the images were able to be read out and printed to PDF and, you know, sort of restored. So that was the 2014 news. And if you want to hear 6 minutes of it, 6 minutes of discussion on that, you can listen to Open Apple 41. At least I have to admit, I didn't re-listen to all of it. But it is at least discussed 2 hours and 33 minutes in.
that was a long one.
But anyway, the news, you know, what brings it to our inbox is that Nick Gibbons, who is a Traveler fan, an archivist, and a graphic designer, has resurrected this in a way. So it was in time for they I guess have a annual May Day, and this, so that was May 1st. Nick Gibbons had you know, basically gotten this all together to basically make it available. I think he sort of typeset it, and I think it will soon be available for physical purchasing. But yeah, May Day 2022 event. There's some in-game thing that this relates to. So they're still having annual sort of conventions even to this day. But in time for that, this was released, the Mega Traveler Adventure Manhunt. And so you can get a $10 PDF. And there's also a little article. We'll link to this in the show notes, but it's basically talking about the history of this, like how it came to be restored. So it's if you want to read this more. Part of what made this kind of a thing was that there were ads for it. So the publisher actually, you know, had the submission, started promoting it, but then pulled the plug on the whole project before it actually came out. So it was sort of vaporware that people knew existed, kind of, but nobody had. So anyway.
And it's kind of funny that it was in Magic Window format, which was not a popular word processor on the Apple II. Like, that was a pretty obscure one. We're not talking about AppleWorks or WordStar here. This was like, yeah, this was quite a niche file format. So it was kind of neat that they had to jump through all those hoops to get it out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fun story from the retro computing perspective, you know, like the lost data, which is restored by, you know, contacting the writer of ADT Pro or whatever, you know. So, and if you know Traveler, you have just missed May Day 2022, but there will probably be one in 2023.
But the important point here is that Open Apple broke the story 6 years ago. So
that's right.
It's nice of you to recap it here, yep. But just saying.
Yeah. Okay, there were a couple of things. In FujiNet news, a very short Mastodon client was written for, I think, both the Atom and the Atari. Mastodon is this, we talked about this before, right, when everybody was deciding, you know, that we needed to abandon Twitter. Periodically, we have this decision to make, and Mastodon always comes up as a...
Oh, is that an alternate Twitter?
Yeah, it's sort of slightly decentralized.
Okay. And, but not going for it is the fact that people are always saying, oh, it's like Linux. You know, it's sort of, it's more technical. It's a little more hardcore. I don't know. It seems like I have not found myself a fan of it, but it seems to be something a lot, some people are trying to switch to. I am going to give it another chance. But yeah, so a client for some of the, it's always good to have new clients for new retro systems. Which systems were they again, Paul?
Well, it was being demonstrated as an Atari and an Atom application. I'm trying to find the FujiNet has a I think it's like a JSON parser or something built into it. So part of what was interesting about this was that it was a very short client.
And you're saying the Atom version also utilizes FujiNet as well. I know FujiNet's spreading to different platforms. Is Atom one of them? I guess I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah. So this is the picture of it running on an Atari. So it says, and here we go, world's simplest Mastodon client for Atari 8-bit, written in Atari BASIC using FujiNet's built-in JSON parser. Yes, that's all the code.
That is a light client.
Yeah, so that's, it doesn't seem like it does anything except read, but it's still pretty cool.
And it's literally running on the Atari. Yeah.
I mean, you know, Mastodon or not, it's still cool that it has this kind of a parser built in, that it can extract that information.
Can someone explain that to me? How does FujiNet have a built-in JSON parser? Like it detects JSON data and creates native data objects out of it somehow? How does that work?
That is a good question. Maybe it's determinable here. It looks to me, just kind of like skimming what I'm seeing in this code, that you ask the FujiNet, like, give me what's in this tag or whatever.
Oh, I see. It holds the data for you, and you can make requests. I see. Okay, that's cool.
So it's sort of, I guess in a way, it is just acting like another addressable data storage. You know, it's like a disk drive almost.
That's really clever because parsing JSON is pretty onerous for retro machines because even though it's just text, it's a lot of it, and there's a lot of parsing to do. So and so much of the internet is JSON blobs. That's a good feature.
Yeah. So anyway, kind of neat.
Interesting. Is the Atom version, I guess, is also in BASIC.
Let's see. Maybe I can find the photo of that.
While you're looking for the photo, are any of you? I know Paul, you're on Mastodon. I'm on Mastodon. Are people using it and finding it, a useful and pleasant thing? Or
I have not tried it.
I haven't tried it either.
Yeah. I've been on it for 4 years or whenever the last Twitter apocalypse was.
Yes. I think we joined on the same day, didn't we? Or something like that. Yeah, back 3 years ago or something. And I logged in the second time the other day. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I do get notifications when I get followed or whatever. But the thing is, it's all of these social networks have the same problem, which is that they're pointless unless everybody's there. And nobody's going to go there unless everybody's there. And so...
I'd like to point out this is the only moment in history where the sentence Mastodon client for the Coleco Atom makes any sense at all.
Hashtag episode 255.
Before this or after this, no one's going to understand this project at all.
Or maybe hashtag FF would be a better way to go.
Jeremy in the chat says it's always best to name your platform after extinct animals. Makes you confident it will last. I guess it's not good, it's not getting any worse, right?
Yeah, that's why we like retro platforms. The platform stabilized because it's dead. So right. nothing more stable than death.
That's that, Quinn. That's one to get embroidered on a throw pillow, I think.
That's right.
There's nothing more stable than death.
Let's see. And then why did I have this here? I think this must have been a feedback that somebody sent. Mark, yes, sent this over feedback. Pointing out that Identify 2 is available. And this is version 2.10. And I mean, like the specifics of this don't matter all that much, but it's kind of an interesting problem and solution. So the the computers, so that what this specifically is for Apple IIs to identify their configuration, how much memory they have, what kind of cards they have in them, you know, like what capabilities are available. And, you know, they weren't built at that time to report this to you, right? I mean, so you have to do all kinds of like individual specific tricks to figure out, like, does the memory in this, you know, slot area behave like what I would expect it to behave like if it had a booty card in it, or if it had a, you know, 80 column card in it of a particular sort or whatever. This is the, you know, current evolution of this, which has included a couple of modern cards, you know, a Raspberry Pi card and actually a clone of an older card, a RAM Factor card. But it's kind of interesting, first of all, that this is something, now it's much easier to do this in a way because it's a large collaborative effort. You know, the internet can help try to get this to be more perfect. But it's also, it's interesting that it is a problem, you know, that you really, you have to do really funny tricks to figure out, like, is there memory here? You know, how many banks of memory are here? That kind of thing.
That's neat, actually. Yeah, it is a hard problem. I wrote a mouse driver for the Apple II in a moment of insanity several years ago, and half the code, I think, is trying to figure out, is there a mouse, and if so, which virtual or physical slot is it in? That is a lot of effort to determine, it turns out.
One place that this shows up, this I don't think Identify 2 specifically is being used for this, but this this problem is being solved by Total Replay. The, you know, one of the features of Total Replay, which is this sort of like packaging of a large number of sort of the canon of Apple II games, is that it will try to figure out, you know, how many, do you have a 64K machine or a 128K machine? Do you have double high res available to you or not? Do you have a joystick? You know, and it will try to figure all these things out and show you only the games that are relevant for you, which is amazing.
That is really cool.
One last thing, which is Greg on Facebook mentioned that he's repairing an ET3400. That's a Heath Kit thing. And he was wondering if there's any technique for removing and replacing the paper labels that are on it without damaging them so that the case under them can be cleaned. I would be interested to know that. I have no idea.
What? Sorry, say again. What are these paper labels on?
They're on plastic in this case. But so the idea is, I guess, that in this instance, the case is gunky, and the hope would be to clean it, but not destroy the labels at the same time.
Gotcha. So one technique that I've had some success with, though, with any technique like this, practice on something else, because it doesn't necessarily guarantee to work. But basically, what you need is a very, very mild solvent, something that will attack the glue and not the paper or the plastic that the sticker is made of. One such solvent is vegetable oil. Vegetable oil is a very, very slow solvent for most glues. So during a pinball machine restore, I succeeded in removing the label from a control panel and cleaning up the metal underneath and then gluing it back down just by putting the whole piece in vegetable oil and soaking it for like a day, and eventually the glue would come off, and then you can use like dental floss to get behind the sticker and separate it. But, you know, again, it's not zero risk. There's a chance that the sticker could be ruined doing that. So, you know.
Yeah, I guess that would be the thing that I would worry about, is that it would just wind up being like an oily sticker. But
yeah, that certainly can happen. It depends on what the sticker is made of, for sure. If it's, you know, if it's plastic, it works better. If it's a paper sticker, if there's a lot of paper in the sticker, then it may have just absorbed the oil and kind of get wrecked. But if it's a plastic sticker, then that does work pretty well. Aside from that, honestly, for paper stickers, if it's fragile, you're probably better off just reproducing it. Just, you know, removing it with Goo Gone or something and then just reproducing it.
Yeah, could be.
Especially, yeah, something like this warning sticker here in the picture. I mean, it's, you know, a sans serif font with a single black line and some text. I mean, you could just scan that and reproduce it pretty easily, print out a new one. It's probably your best bet.
It feels wrong, but yeah. I mean, you know, the next person who sees it wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Which also feels wrong, but...
Well, and the thing to remember with a situation like that is you don't have anything to lose. Like, if you have to get that sticker off, like if the case underneath it is rusted or you have to clean it or whatever, you're going to lose it anyway. So you might as well try and save it. And if you can, great. Otherwise, you are going to have to reproduce it anyway. So that's kind of the, I think a lot of people get scared to try stuff like that because they're afraid of making it worse. But if you're going to have to destroy the sticker to get it off anyway, then you don't actually have anything to lose by trying. Actually, one more thing on that sticker. So another good technique that does work on paper stickers is heat. So there's basically no glue in the world that can stand up to heat. The question is only how much heat, and is the heat required to release the glue more than the paper and or plastic underneath it can handle. But you could try something like a hairdryer first, and then if that's not enough, then you could try a heat gun at a low setting far away from the plastic so as not to, to melt it. But heat is also a pretty good universal glue releaser.
Yeah, I would feel quite nervous about that, but at the same time, I would have felt nervous about the oil too. So,
yeah, I mean, put your hand there, like next to the sticker, while you do it, because then if your hand doesn't get burnt, then you're not hurting the plastic.
Okay,
one way to get around that. But I mean, if the glue is old, it probably doesn't need much heat. So, like a hairdryer is probably enough. So I would probably try that first. And the sticker in the photo actually looked like it was bubbling up off the surface. So if there's any way to get dental floss behind it, like with a metal pick or something, then you can just dental floss it right off from there.
Cool. Well, hopefully that will work. Maybe we will get a report back as to whether it did. All right. I think that is it for the feedback. So now we can turn to items of interest and news. The first item of interest and or news is Earl's.
So Curious Mark has a great YouTube channel where he fixes up a lot of old computers and peripherals and sometimes even computing equipment from the Apollo Moonshot era, which is really awesome. But in this particular case, he's tweeting from an ASR33 teletype. So I have to first ask the question, am I the only one that is used an ASR33 or any teletype for real work as opposed to just a retro experience? Have any of you used an ASR33 like in the course of your life?
Nope.
I've never even seen one.
I figured I'm the dinosaur. We had one at my school, and that's why we used it. We had an acoustic coupler. 110 bods, which is, way more than you ever need, connecting up to the time-sharing system downtown at Los Angeles Unified School District. But anyway, I love the ASR33 because it's a noisy beast. It weighs, I think, 17 metric tons, approximately. And it has a gazillion springs on the inside, although we never popped the hood on ours, but I'm told they're very complex electromechanical devices, and repairing them takes a certain amount of knowledge of how all those things work, none of which I have, but I just love the aesthetic of the ASR33, especially with the paper tape punch and reader on the left-hand side. I love the kerchunk sound that it makes, and you hear a lot of this in the video. And we'll have a link for this in the show notes, or you can just look around on YouTube for it. Tweeting from a teletype, I think, is a great trick. And the reason that we had feedback on this is because Carrington had said something about wishing he had an ASR33 just sitting there receiving tweets like the old stock tickers. Mm-hmm. And the sender... And I don't have the document open because my computer is acting really weird today, but maybe you could tell me who it was from again, Paul.
This was feedback from Dave over email.
Dave. Yeah, thank you, Dave. And Dave points out that maybe this video is what pushes Carrington over the edge to finally get an ASR33. He certainly got room for it in his empty apartment. So
that's right.
This is one of the only things that is left on my wish list. I'm pretty much full in terms of my retro computing collection, but man, if I ever found a working ASR33, despite the fact that it's big and heavy and clunky and difficult to repair, I would still have to have one of these. Because it's just, this is the iconic thing. I mean, this is what you saw in all the old sci-fis, right, in the 60s and 70s. They all had, and here in the video, if you're happening to watch the YouTube There's a tweet that comes across the teletype, and then Curious Mark shows the tweet actually appearing on his smartphone. So,
yeah,
I think that's pretty cool.
I think watching videos like this, it's always important to imagine them from before this time looking forward and not as now looking backwards, because it's easy to watch a video like this and go, well, computing like that must have been insufferable, right? Because you're waiting 5 minutes for it to type out the prompt and then you type. But the thing I think to remember is that any form of interactivity was so amazing at the time, because this was, you know, at the vanguard of interactivity period. Prior to this would have been primarily batch processing, where you waited 3 days to find out if your program compiled or not. So yeah, I think that's
a very, very good way to look at things, in the right way.
Yeah, in the context of the time, it was really incredible to have any amount of real-time interactivity, even if it was as slow and as loud and as cumbersome as this clearly is.
Well, and what we did with our Fortran programs was to bubble them out with a number two pencil on MarkSense cards, send them downtown where we had, and you nailed it, Quinn, we had a two-day turnaround on getting those programs back. And then, of course, yeah, the mistakes that were inevitable, you had to fix and then send it through again, wait another 2 days to find out whether or not you've actually fixed the problem. And having something that you could type on and get the results instantly, and not only that, but not a compiled environment, but of course, when we would dial in, we would typically use BASIC. And so you'd have instant feedback on whether you had any problems with your program. So it was high tech. I mean, this was, let me see, we had the teletype there in 19, this would have been 79, 80. So even by then, teletypes were kind of becoming retro and, you know, passé, but this was a school district and we had what we could afford, which was one of these, and they probably had, you know, a gazillion year service contract on them. So it was better than sending bunches of punch cards, that's for sure. Now, how was it compared to, in our particular lab, moving 5 feet to the right and using a TRS-80 Model 1? It was pretty clunky compared to that. But compared to the punch cards, it was a dream.
The sound is really something, too, when you listen to this video. There's an interesting effect where you hit the key and there's a little bit of a delay before it goes ka-chunk. And so the you know, like when you're typing, it's a really interesting effect. You know, you can hear the key go down, you hear the ka-chunk, but sometimes simultaneous with the next key going down. And I could see having kind of a nostalgia for that. I guess typewriters did that sort of a little bit in the slightly in the middle era, you know, where there were a little bit electronic, you know, there would be a little bit of a delay between the key hitting and the actual mechanism moving.
There is that, but even with the teletype here, you've got whatever's on the inside, the timing cylinder and the gears, they're moving when you're not typing. So when the machine's just sitting there, it has this cool industrial vibe. You know, this sound that...
very literal vibe. Yeah,
exactly. And then when you type it, it just makes everything better.
They're very steampunky, right? It's very much a clockwork kind of technology. Like, it's much more mechanical than they are electronic.
Yeah, it definitely has a look to it, a presence.
You can see when the when you actually get a carriage return that the whole thing goes like sways too, which is pretty excellent.
And they don't show it in this video, but the paper tape was awesome too. Mm-hmm. Our time online was limited, so we would type our BASIC programs and punch them out on this paper tape. And then you had, you know, a bunch of little spools of paper tape that you were carrying around with you in your backpack. And then when you finally did get some time on the time sharing system, then you could just load in the paper tape and boom, Bob's your uncle. You had your, it was like a player piano. So cool.
Mm-hmm. I assume that the keys didn't go down with the,
no.
with the punches.
In that
right?
way, it wasn't like a player piano, but you still had all the cool sounds.
Yeah. All right. I think I am next. Is that correct? Yes. So this also came from feedback. Garrett wrote over email to talk about, I forget exactly what we were talking about, memory technology or something. That's often been what we've been talking about. But Garrett wrote to say, one of the earliest computers I programmed on was a UNIVAC with a fast RAND drum storage. The drum held code and temporary files, and the data files were on open reel tapes. And he says, the fast RAND was by far the most physically terrifying piece of computing equipment I've beheld. So the thing about it is, it's got this huge metal drum that spins like at a very high rate. And, you know, so it's loud and dangerous. But the other thing is, too, that the physics of it meant that it wanted to walk around the room. So, like, you know, they had to bolt it down, you know, to try to keep it contained. But I mean, even so, it was still, you know, it would get loose sometimes and you know, sort of terrify people in the computer room.
It's like your washer, yeah. But a lot scarier.
It's enormous. It looks like about the size of like four refrigerators side by side, sort of.
It could crush you. Yeah, it could definitely crush you.
So the fast round two, what they, you know, the solution to this was they had added a second drum that spins in the other direction.
countershaft.
Yeah, so at least it doesn't it was less enthusiastic to, you know, stomp on everybody. But anyway, he said it weighed a couple of tons. This is Garrett again. It weighed a couple of tons, and most of that was the two spinning drums. He said, I particularly enjoy the Wikipedia article contributor, including the metric of weight per kilobyte, 6 ounces.
Drum storage had, didn't they have a great many read-write heads, like all in a row or something like that? Am I remembering? I remember in college in my operating systems class, the guy took us through, like in college 50 years ago, took us through a history, you know, of like, you know, how swap memory used to work, and he pointed to the drum, and I feel like it had just a big row of heads, do you know anything about that?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the thing that is referred to as drum memory. I think it did come up on the one of the most recent episodes. That is, yes, I think there is a, you know, it's essentially a head per track or whatever. I don't know if the faster
is that not similar to this? Do you think this is this a different? Do they happen to both be called drums, but they're very much not alike? Is that what you're saying?
They could be, I guess is all I'm saying. Like, I don't know. Quinn, you said, I think that you had seen some of the displays of these like drum memories.
Yeah, the Computer History Museum in San Jose has drum memory on display. And I think, yeah, there's different, I think it's possible and likely that that word gets used in a couple of different ways. That what we saw here with the fast RAND is what they have, but there's also something very similar where it's vertical and it's a stack of magnetic platters and there's one head per platter. And then I think some of those, the platters are removable like on a Winchester drive, but I don't know all the specific names and variations of them.
Yeah, it sounded to me like this, at least in the context of the feedback we got, this fast RAND 2 was really sort of like RAM, you know, like it's the operating memory. And anything that was supposed to persevere was on tape on a different drive.
Yeah, I think this is basically a magnetic delay line of sorts, but just wrapped around a drum, essentially. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's actually a read head on it per se, if it works like a wax cylinder record player, or if it's just like a delay line. I'm not sure exactly how they work.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anyway, so thanks for that feedback. And Quinn, you have the next thing.
Yeah, so I'll start with a sort of a quickie bonus item because we've been talking a lot lately about web emulators of increasingly obscure computers. So this is a web emulator of the Kenback 1,
cool.
Which many people claim to be the first home computer. Anytime you talk about first of anything, there's going to be an internet argument, but I thought it was neat that someone went to the trouble to make a web emulator of this thing. Like all of these super early computers, it's extremely difficult to get it to do anything or appear that it's working, but you can at least turn it on, and if you click the start button, you can see it running through memory, and it stops when it gets to each zero, which is presumably a break, and there's lights, and you know, I'm sure you could program it. It appears to be fully functional, but you want to program a Ken back one. You can now do so.
Earl, don't you have a Ken back one?
No, I don't have one of these. There was a reproduction that was really popular for a lot of people were building them. I think that they don't have a CPU per se. I thought that they were a CPU constructed of TTL logic.
Yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah. Interesting.
That's what Wikipedia is now telling me.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So it's technically a mini computer then.
I think I kind of dove in randomly, but on your lovely old podcast, Earl, I think the first episode I heard was you were reporting on the reproduction, the remake of the Ken Beck one. That's why I'm associating you with that. I think that was the first episode I heard back over 10 years ago. Yeah.
Wow, that's been a minute then.
Yeah.
since that reproduction came out.
I think they were slightly smaller. That's what I seem to recall. Like they were a scale model of some kind.
Yeah, I don't know how big this is from this emulator, but presumably fairly large. If it's a discrete CPU, it must be pretty substantial in size, this thing. Also, it's notable that the memory display here appears to be octal, so it's it might be a 4-bit or 7-bit machine. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It does appear that like in the simulator, you have three zeros to play with.
I know absolutely nothing about this machine. I saw the emulator and I'm like, oh, neat. So here we are. All right. Well, that was a quickie, but let's move on to the thing I actually wanted to talk about, which is this came to my attention from one of our previous recordings. I forget exactly how I came across it, but this is a repair series of an HP 9830A desktop calculator. Every so often you stumble onto a gem of a YouTube channel that has basically no subscribers yet is amazing, and this is one of those channels. So this is Jerry Walker. It's clear that he does this a lot, that he repairs vintage machines, and the detail here is amazing, and it's a really amazing calculator, and this has to be one of the, if not the most epic retro repair that I have ever seen. So it's a quick 27-part series. so this is also and each part is, some of them are up to an hour long. This is also a discrete logic system. So the scale of this system is mind-boggling. I think he estimated the total number of TTL chips somewhere north of 1,500, somewhere 1,500 to 2,000 chips. And the level of damage in this thing is equally astonishing. In the end, he decided that it was probably a U.S. Model that was plugged into European power, like a 120 that was plugged into 220. Ooh. So imagine a system that's, say, 2,000 TTL chips and 700 or so of those chips randomly all over the entire machine are bad. And now you have to fix it. And that's what he does in this series. It's really something to behold. Just to give you a taste of how this goes, the first thing he does, as you might expect, is, well, let's see if there's... He turns it on, nothing happens. So, okay, well, let's see if there's power getting to the power supply. The power connector where the line cord goes in was fried. So right away, we're in trouble. So he replaces that with a new power connector. And then the next thing up on the chain, the power switch, the insides of the power switch were completely vaporized. So he takes apart the power switch and replaces the contacts and puts it all. So that gives you a taste of how the entire thing goes.
Was there no fuse? I mean, it you know, I would kind of expect a fuse to blow before all the rest of those components would be annihilated.
Yeah, it had fuses. They were all blown. He talks a little bit about that. It actually had quite extensive protection circuits in the power supply, and all of them were insufficient. There's a crossbar switch. There's a bunch of fuses. There's a bunch of other things. All of it somehow failed.
Wow.
And the scale of the damage is pretty shocking. And just the amount of diagnosis. I mean, it's full disclosure, it's pretty hardcore content. I mean, there's hours of time spent in the logic analyzer trying to figure out, you know, which leg of this gate is not being enabled when that thing over there tries to do, like, it's a lot of that. But if you, yeah, if you like that kind of thing, I watched all 27 parts and I was riveted. So, yeah, he does manage to fully restore it, and it's really an incredible repair. It's worth skimming through it too, because it really is an incredible machine. It's kind of the height of HP's design kind of process. You know, they were really good at the physical design. Like, all, it's all boards stuck into a backplane, and it's a discrete CPU. So, like, there's each of these boards is like 12 inches long, and like three of the boards are just a register, for example. So this is an enormously complex set of chips for doing very little, but all the boards are color coded and everything snaps into place. You can swap out individual boards. Like, it's a very, very elegant industrial design. And the other thing I love about this is that it's kind of peak HP. It was from that period when they were trying to iterate calculators into a computer, and you really can't. It's like, no matter how good a horse you breed, you're never going to get a Model T. But HP was convinced that they could iterate from calculator to computer, and so this thing is right at the peak of that. So it runs code. It's got its own elaborate programming language. It's got a very elaborate display, a full keyboard, full everything, but it's still just a calculator. It's a very, very, very fancy calculator. And it's hard to imagine exactly what the use case for it was. But I'm fascinated by it. So worth a watch, even if you do just skim through it a little bit. Some of the more hardcore parts might be a little slow for a lot of people, but I loved it.
Excellent. And actually, you had one bonus item that none of us have anything in between. Did you want to do that or not?
Yeah, all right. So this one is, we've talked a lot about this lately. So recently we talked about that. We found that marketing thing that was like a Apple-branded cassette player with a tape in it. And we were all kind of marveling at what exactly that was for and what marketing person at Apple thought that was a good idea. This is from that same school of thought. So again, from that period, this is from 1987, when Apple clearly had more money than sense. They were riding high on their Apple II profits. The financial disaster of the Macintosh had not perhaps hit yet, and they produced this album called the Apple Boogie. Have we talked about this before? Because I feel like we must have.
Familiar.
May have come up in like an eBay auction or something at some point. But
okay,
yeah.
So recently this was posted, and so someone digitized this cassette tape and posted it on YouTube. So it's all here. It's nicely produced. They got a scan of the artwork from the cassette and everything. It appears to be, it's a full music album that appears to have been distributed to Apple marketing people and probably also played at sales conferences and things like that. Mm-hmm. Because all the songs are like rah, rah, sell hard for Apple, we can beat IBM kind of stuff. A lot of it is original music, and a lot of it is like parody music. So there's a song called Blue Busters, which is a parody of the Ghostbusters theme, but like sticking it to IBM.
Uh-huh. There's a video for that, by the way.
Yes, and there's a video. Not gonna lie, this thing is a hard listen. Like, the cheese is some hard, hard cheese right here. Hopefully, Paul can put some clips of it in this podcast. But you know, there's a song that it's all done by these two people. This couple that's clearly a small-time singer, songwriter, producer couple, and clearly they were asked like to do one power ballad and one rap and one this and one that. So there's each of them in a very, very 80s style. So that's part of the hilarity of it is that they're creating the styles of the time. But yeah, I couldn't listen to more than a few seconds of each of these songs because it's rough. But it's worth skimming through it anyway.
If you've ever heard the Apple II Forever song, that is that's on this, also from the, I don't know if it was originally on this, but it is, you know, among the songs on this.
Very much in the same vein, yeah. And yeah, there's at least some of them have videos, which I also linked to in the show notes. The Blue Busters song, for example, has a video, part of which includes some cheesy special effects of three old dudes dressed as Ghostbusters who I assume are probably marketing VPs or something that everyone would know, and so it would be a funny moment if you saw it at the sales conference or whatever. But yeah, again, it's tough listen.
Yeah.
it's funny. I've seen a number of company I'd never heard of this before. This is astonishing. I'm going to have to definitely watch and listen to the video, especially the Blues Buster video, which sounds like it would be incredible. But yeah, like there was a HP did an internal a rap video, sort of a guy in a zoot suit is dancing about the HP 9000 series of HP UX workstations. And I think there was a some kind of a medieval Oracle or SGI. Yeah, it's just funny how many companies apparently did this for they were all internal. You know, it was not
right.
Something to be, you know, seen outside. It's sort of making it, it's makes it amazingly humorous, you know, to see it. But yeah, it's
in a bad way.
It's
amusingly funny. Terrible.
I remember. So there's this one on my YouTube channel. I put a friend of mine was actually it's my wife's best friend from like high school. They used to make, you know, she and this girl would like give each other mixtapes and things like that. One of the tapes on the back, like her father worked at Pitney Bowes, and she made a mixtape and gave it to my wife, and the back was still this Pitney Bowes content, and it was like a sales, inspirational speaking tape that talked about, you know, the Pitney Bowes mission, and they invoked Gunga Din, like this whole tribal overcoming in the face of death adversity. It was incredible, and that was from like the 60s or something. It's nuts, but
this corporate internal marketing schlock is always very reflective of its time. So in the same way that was like 60s tribal philosophy, this is very 80s rah-rah, like the power of belief, and if you just try hard enough you can be your best kind of, it's a lot of that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's very, very of its time, and it's very of that corporate marketing committee. Even the title, like the Apple Boogie, like you couldn't come up with a better designed by committee album name from 1987.
That's incredible. I can't wait to listen to these. I had not seen this before you mentioned it just now.
I mean, it was posted in January of this year, last year. It's kind of amazing that 40 years later, this stuff's still turning up and getting recorded and put online.
It puts a little fear into me as far as what else might be lurking out there of a similar vein. Mm-hmm. It's
okay. I think that'll do it for the news. And so now, a word from our sponsor.
Ora c'è una memoria da elefante per il vostro computer. Direttamente dagli Stati Uniti arriva Elephant Memory System. Mini e micro floppy disk ad affidabilità garantita. Elephant Memory System, distribuiti in Italia da King Mac, i professionisti in ufficio.
Dus een lasercomputer.
Je eigen lasercomputer met Intel Pentium processor.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retro computing gift idea, I'm not sure how inspired this is. I was trying to find something that was kind of 8-bit related, and this is what I ended up with. It is a retro 8-bit game cartridge cutting board. It is a cutting board designed to look, you know, like a wooden cutting board with little design in it. Supposed to look like a cartridge. What kind of cartridge is this?
Nintendo cartridge, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it looks nice. It's got a lot of little, you know, places for gunk to accumulate.
Yeah, it looks virtually impossible to clean, so you would use it once.
Yeah. Sold by Cutting Boredom on Etsy, which I think is kind of nice.
That's a good name.
Yeah. So it's $65 is what they're asking for. I think it, you know, it might be worth it, but it's also a joke. So up to you. But I thought it was kind of interesting. You can, it looks like you can choose the wood that it's made of, and you can get it engraved. That's about it. I don't have much more to say about that. But anyway, if you were looking for a cutting board, then this is an option. Actually, I guess if your friends who are retro computing enthusiasts were looking for a cutting board, this is an option for a gift for them. That's how that's supposed to work. Okay, and once you're done buying cutting boards, we can move on to eBay, and Blake has the first eBay auctions.
Okay, so the first item that I have, it's nothing, you know, groundbreaking. It's just, it's a 386SX computer, standard PC clone in a pizza box-ish style. And the reason that it stood out to me is I always find it interesting. The company is Laser, video technology, VTech being behind it. One of my favorite computers, actually, one of the computers I most enjoyed at a certain point in the 80s was a Laser 128, which is a one of the better Apple II clones, Apple IIc, IIe clones, I really like that machine for a variety of reasons, and I know that they had some Apple IIc form factor PC clones as well, and some general beige box PCs, but this happens to be a laser PC clone I had never seen before, and it's just interesting to see what that company was doing, around and after, I was using their hardware. I know they, we've had a number of learning computers. I think they have had some kids' computers that are, more educational. And I don't know if they even still exist. Do we know if Video Technology still exists?
I don't know. I think anyone? They do.
I feel like VTech still exists. I think they probably got bought by somebody else, but I'm pretty sure I've seen their logo on kids' toys and stuff. Like, I think that stuff still exists.
I feel like there was a kid's laptop-ish looking thing.
I think they probably got bought by Mattel or Hasbro.
They haven't used the Laser name in quite a while, but this is, Laser 386SX/3. I don't know if /3 is, maybe there were several of these, but I find it interesting because there's the logo of Laser, and I had a good experience with them, and so that's it. Interesting to note. And the second item that I have, I actually almost during this podcast bought this, but I haven't, and I probably could. There's a couple of other items of similar price that might be better off being part of my money expenditure, but it's a Millennium Y2K. Referred to as more of a work of art, I guess. There's an artist named R.D. Brown who created this quite a while ago, 1999, and it's a little bug, about 3 inches tall, beetle-looking thing, like something out of A Bug's Life, or, and kind of humorous, fun-looking, chewing on a 3.5-inch floppy disk. Came originally, I looked into it, I actually didn't see the auction. This is a buy it now for $100. It's a very cute little thing, I think. It has a couple of scratches. I looked on past auctions, and there were none that I could find. And I don't see it. Mm-hmm. It does not look like they were. Like, these are things that come around a lot that that move through eBay with frequency, making it more appealing. The original came in a bottle. It came like you might have an insect in a little glass jar. It has a plastic top and some kind of a little warning label, humorous, and it had like a leaf, but I think the leaf was made of somehow representationally made of silicon or something, just like a motherboard leaf or something. It's cute. I came within a hair's breadth of purchasing it in the middle of the show, but I didn't. So I may do it. It may or may not be around, and I may or may not be the reason for that. But it's $100. It's a buy it now. I think it's quite cute, actually.
Is this like a high end figurine from the time, or is it one of those like schlocky gift store things that your grandparents would get you?
I don't think it's super schlocky, because when I looked it up, it was the pages I found it on were referring to it as a, like, I think there was this and that, you know, gallery item, this gallery item. So I think it's okay. I think it might actually be considered a fairly high quality thing. And I think $100 might not be nuts for it. There seems to be some, you know, it's not grouped in with schlocky stuff when I Google it. Right. So, and it doesn't, I don't see a lot of references to it. So it's quite cute, but anyway, so that jumped out at me. But
yeah, the price was either very reasonable or very terrible, depending on whether this was like actual art or just cheap gift store junk.
Yeah, I think it's, did I read, I think it's glass or ceramic. I can't recall. Okay. It doesn't look plastic, okay. But anyway.
So maybe it was a limited run of things that this artist did.
Yeah, so we'll see. Cool. But it's cute. And it that's it for, that's, those are the only two I've got for this episode.
All right. Good. Earl, you have the next ones. Oh, actually, there was one thing I wanted to say about this, which is not related at all to it. But in the photo, they're trying to illustrate like how tall this thing is, and so they stuck it next to a tape measure, but then they took it at this angle that makes it like completely useless. You can't tell like how tall it actually is. It's, you know.
I was doing the mental calculate, like the 3D transform necessary, and they put the tape measure's about an inch and a half out front of the thing, you know, so it's not on the same plane in 2D space. And yes, they've taken it at an angle, so it could be anywhere between 2 and 4 inches tall, you know. I don't know, it's hard to say.
Anyway, I just found that amazing.
I did note the oddity of that. Like, they should have just put like a perfect. I laugh about it. It became an inside joke with some friends of mine, you know, buying on eBay. There was, in the span of like 3 months, there were 3 items that were on sale on eBay, and they were, I think one was retro computing related, the other two were gaming or something. But in order to show the size, they put like a perfect sphere. It wasn't any known size. It was just a little round ball, or large. You know, it was either huge. I don't know how big it was. It was a perfect detailless sphere, like a red ball. And for scale, ball added for scale. How big is the ball? You know, like
a spherical chicken in a vacuum.
I mean, put a banana or a shoe. You know, but like yes, the ball. It's like, thank you for this. Yeah, excellent.
I think at one point when this must have been, you know, probably in the late 70s or early 80s, visiting Washington, D.C., possibly the Smithsonian, I got some novelty, very large coins, you know, so like a quarter, you know, that was very large. And I think I also had maybe one of them was a Susan B. Anthony dollar or something like that, you know. But that actually would be a pretty good thing to put in your photo.
You know. Yeah. My daughter gave me, for some reason, it's an extremely detailed, tiny, tiny little coffee mug that you can zoom in, you know, and it looks exactly like the proportions are perfect. And, you know, so you could, I've done some photo tricks. I'd like fill it with a few drops of coffee, you know, and set it there. It looks, I know what you're saying. That's funny. I love the perfect sphere. So anyway, go get that Millennium Bug and enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay, Earl, you have the next ones.
The first auction that I'll talk about, I put in the show notes, it was weird. And by the time people look at this, there may be additional information. So you might look at it and go, well, why did Earl think this was weird? It looks weird right now because here's what it says. First computer manufactured, Altair S100. So it doesn't even call it an Altair 8800. And then there's some words under that I can't quite read, Paul, because they're not big enough for me here on the screen share. Can you read them?
It says, built by Kit by Rick Inatome, computer pioneer.
I'm not familiar with the name of the person that they reference here. It could still be somebody very important in computer history, but the name didn't register with me instantly. Any of you?
No.
Okay.
And we apologize to Rick.
We do, absolutely. This could indeed be a computer pioneer that I'm just not familiar with. So, but no additional information on that. The starting bid is $3,000. The price, if you want to buy it outright, is $5,000, which, depending on the condition and the contents, might not be out of line for one of the Altair 8800s of this particular style. This is the one with the blue highlights and the front panel switches and lights. However, there's only one picture in the auction. It's at a cockeyed angle. It looks like it's been partially cropped or something like that, but not in a good way.
With like a bad Photoshop outline.
Yeah, it's been hastily carved out of some other photo. Yeah.
Right, and then if you scroll down, there's no other photos of it, and the description of it is extremely sparse. I think you...
There it is.
Yeah, a little bit. Because, can you read the description?
Yeah, it says... it says basically the same thing it said up there, but first computer manufactured, Altair S100. S100 computer is the first computer sold. It features an 8080 processor.
And that's it in terms of the description.
Item specifics? Vintage? Yes.
And they're looking for $5,000 for this. So this just struck me as incredibly weird. I would want to know what boards are inside it, what's its cosmetic condition, is it functional? Basically, about 100 times more information than what they included in this auction to know. Assuming I had that much money in my piggy bank, which I don't, but if I was a collector looking to buy this, there's so much more I would want to know than what's in the auction. Yeah. And I don't even know if this photo is of the actual one that they're selling or if it's some other photo that they found online or something.
That's what I think. I think this photo is from online or it was scanned from a magazine or something. It doesn't look like a real photo of the unit they specifically have.
Yeah.
This whole auction is really sketchy. This doesn't feel right.
So apologies to the person listing this on eBay. My intention, you know, is not to be derogatory here, but man, you need a lot more info if you want anybody to bid.
I mean, the seller is new to this, at least this for this particular ID is new. So this is somebody who's only had 2x. So, yeah, that could be part of it.
If it's legit, which I kind of don't think it is, given all this evidence, but if it's legit, it sounds to me like someone found it when they bought a storage unit or an estate sale or something, and they didn't really know what it was, so they Googled it and found someone who called it the first home computer or whatever, and so that's why they put it in the description this way. But,
yeah,
it's clear that they don't really know what it is.
And it does kind of look like the photo was like, you know, they took a photo of all the stuff they got from the storage unit, and then they tried to just trace out the outline of this one thing.
They don't even call it by the right model number. They call it Altair S100, the Altair 8800. S100 is the bus. Everything's wrong with this auction.
Yeah.
Everything's wrong with this auction.
They saw the bus and put that in. Yeah. Oh, S100 bus.
Well, the lighting is too flat. Like, this is clearly not a photograph taken in a normal human space. Like, the lighting is so flat that this has to be either a scan of a magazine or an online photo that's been hastily cropped because it doesn't look right at all.
Yeah. The seller actually also has an MSI.
Oh, can you click on that one? I'd just be curious if sufficient detail on that one.
So this one actually looks like a real photo,
at
least.
Yeah, that's clearly a real photo, yeah.
But who knows if it's a photo of this actual thing that they're selling.
The MSI Vintage Computer S100, another popular model.
Right. S100 card included.
So that was my strange auction, but I actually have a real auction also.
I do want to just reamuse myself with this vintage yes, though, because I assume that's supposed to be like a year or something that you're supposed to put in that field rather than yes, no. But they have anyway. Okay, on to the less weird auction. Is this a less weird auction?
still a little weird. I remember the early days of the web when people were jumping on the web and it was a brand new thing. And you had the Mosaic browser, which was the one from NCSA. And then you had the Netscape browser, which was kind of a commercial evolution of that with Marc Andreessen and the, you know, the formation of Netscape. I've never heard of this, I don't know what you want to call it, version, I guess, of Mosaic called Ventana. Any of you encounter this back in like 95, 96?
I don't think so. It was a Camino. There was a version of something else that I used to use a lot, which was, I forget now what it was a version of, but it wasn't Ventana. That was Camino. I'll look that up later.
So just if you're interested in exploring the internet, this is the easiest way. You can explore the internet's web with this World Wide Web kit. And actually, in some ways, this seems like a neat package of stuff because it had a web browser. It sounds like it had a TCP/IP stack or something like that that came with it. Well, actually, I guess it said it was WinSock compatible. And it had some reference material in here, too. And you got to remember in 95, you know, people are like, what's a World Wide Web? What would I find out there? So there's some introductory material here that would let you know what's on the web, how do you get there, basically bonus material as part of this package. So it seemed pretty cool, and the listing price for this is not bad. It's $29.99 or a make offer for something that has everything in the box. So I did a little bit of reading about this. There was an article in PC Magazine in October of 95 that covered this. They compared it to, I think it was Netscape. They said this particular browser didn't support tables. That's kind of fascinating. That's like, you know, early, like, you know, primordial kind of browser stuff I think about with tables. So this didn't even have tables. And it didn't support some of the Netscape extensions to HTML, but it was, you know, a full package, and it had a lot of interesting stuff in it. And I put it in just because I found it fascinating. There was so much going on in 95, 96, 97 with these kind of web-in-a-box packages that you could buy. I just never encountered this one. So if any of the listeners ever encountered this one, or this is the way that you explored the internet's web back in 95, maybe write us and let us know.
That's crazy. I have on my work shelf at the office, I vaguely remember, like, you know, in the early 90s, mid 90s, buying a Netscape Navigator 2 book on, like, mm-hmm. what it's all about, like, the whole experience. And it was not a development guide. It was just some, I don't know why I bought it. But it's, I have it on the shelf because it says it's 890 pages. Like, it's insane how big. It's literally, you know, I think it's about as thick as all of the, I have the Lord of the Rings set sitting on my bookshelf. It's about as thick as the entire series of Lord of the Rings. It's incredible about internet Netscape Navigator 2, you know, version 2. It's crazy.
I remember a lot of those books were also like half of it was just lists of URLs.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's a whole bunch of websites you can go to, which of course are all immediately gone. But
yeah, and it had like some CD, you know, tape to it, or maybe floppy. I don't know. It's got some big rubber thing with media in it on the back. I don't know.
I had a book, Internet for Dummies, and it was actually one of the best dummies books that I ever had because it didn't just cover the web, but it covered things like the newsgroups and IRC and FTP and basically all the different ways, Gopher, that people used to get around on the early internet, both pre and post World Wide Web kind of internet info. And that was a fascinating book. It was really helpful. And yeah, to Quinn's point, a lot of the material could get outdated quickly. But in the early days, if you wanted to know about the internet, There were some things that you could learn about in a book, and it wasn't moving as insanely fast as it is now. I mean, you could actually get some reference and find some places or links to places, somewhere to start. Because when you're just jumping in, it's like, what do I even do with this?
Yeah.
Those dummies books get a bad rap as the, you know, books your grandparents bought or whatever, but a lot of them were very good. Like, I bought a few of them over the years. Yeah, they were not bad.
Yeah, I think I was going to say I was looking for it on the shelf here. I actually, the only one I've bought in the dummies books I've bought in you know, related to learning on the computer was AppleScript for Dummies, which happened to be the only AppleScript book. I was trying to automate some image, you know, scaling and processing, and it was superb. You know, it told me exactly what I needed to know. It had a little tutorial, had a reference, and I didn't need anything else. So it's I still have it somewhere. I haven't coded any AppleScript in a while, but yeah. So I'll vouch for those books, at least some of them as well.
It is kind of interesting to kind of remember those days, though, when you had, like, yeah, the Yahoo directory or whatever, where you submit, you know, an URL.
Yeah.
Or a URL or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Do we call them the yellow pages of the internet there for quite a while.
Categorized internet was an awesome thing. Mm-hmm. And I realize it couldn't scale to where we are today. But there were so many advantages to that as opposed to a Google search that is just so hit and miss. It's like, maybe you're going to find what you're looking for. Maybe you're going to find something really weird and strange off in a corner, you know, whereas the categorized internet, you could drill down into just what you were looking for. I love that. But yeah, I knew that couldn't last.
Yeah, I think people forget that pre-Google, it was impossible to find anything. So yeah, those services were awesome. Gopher was great for that. Like, you could start broad and drill down through the little menus and get to useful information right away. Because yeah, without that stuff, it was impossible to find anything on the internet.
You could just so quickly, like, you could just three links and you're all the way down, you know, into basically the you know, pool of what you're actually looking for.
Yep. I had for a little while, probably about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, maybe it wasn't quite that long. I was hired by a publisher in a sort of like specialized area to keep up to date a list of links on their site. They had a resource page, and I was you know, heading this particular resource page, and so I would, you know, I'd have to go basically check to see that the links aren't dead, and read the mailing lists to see who had announced you know, some link to their site so that I could put it in there. You know, I was participating in some of that at one point, but it really was frustrating, actually. You know, like, to have to keep checking for dead links, and it just started getting really pointless as soon as there was anything like AltaVista or Google out there.
And back to Earl's item, so that it was also very indicative of that era. Like, the early 90s PC world was very much one of those kits, right? Like, there was multimedia kits, and there was encyclopedia kits, and these web kits, and because there was all this infrastructure that all this new stuff required that most people didn't have, so you had to go buy a kit because it had the CD-ROM drive in it, and then a bunch of CD-ROMs, so you could do something with your new CD-ROM drive, and then it also had a Sound Blaster in it because you need a Sound Blaster to use all this stuff, and yeah, it was you'd go to Best Buy or Fry's or whatever, and it would just be a wall of these kits in that very 90s Times New Roman aqua color style.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. I have a few things here. You know, at random as usual. The first of them is an Elephant Memory Systems mug. I thought that was kind of nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think we all have this like fond memory of Elephant discs. They sort of rode the line between cheap and good, you know. Mm-hmm. So
I've never seen the logo on anything, though. That mug's got to be rare, right?
Yeah, I would think so. I feel like the overall logo is a little more red than it should be. Like, the elephant's head shouldn't be quite this red. But I don't know much about it, but that's not
some new thing. I mean, that's definitely of the time. You can tell.
Yeah, I think so.
And this person, this seller I see, knows how to use a ruler. And,
they put a ruler next to it.
And manipulate three-dimensional space.
yeah. Anyway, so it's being $54 buy it now, or you can make an offer for it. It is coming from North Carolina. Let's see what is next. Yeah, I was sort of looking in this category of things. This is a large glass jar, like a cookie jar, I guess, and it has the Intel Inside logo on it. And I this just seems like a total misfire of an idea. I don't understand what the point of this was. I mean, like, it's a thing that contains stuff, but I don't think it is ever going to contain anything that is Intel.
I wonder, do you think at a trade show, maybe they filled it with, like, you know, Intel memory chips or something, and you took it as, like, tchotchkes or something?
I hope so, because otherwise this is just a really kind of, like, ideas that were jumbled together and did not quite fuse properly.
It looks like one of those things you'd see at a trade show where you're supposed to put your business card in it, and then you get garbage spam for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, either that, or maybe it's you know, you could use it as a place to drop your spy communications or whatever, so that the next spy who comes along can tell where to find it.
It's just my it's my data bash stuff, but aesthetically, I don't really like this because the other logo on the other side of the jar is showing through on the front, and it just kind of all blends together.
It only works if it's full of chips.
I guess
you can't see the other side. It's odd.
Yeah. This might be apocryphal, but have you guys heard the story about when they launched the 6502 that Moss brought them to a trade show and they had them in a big cookie jar, and because they were $20 a piece, which was, you know, a tenth of anything else you could buy at the time, and so they were practically giving them away like candy, and people were like, I don't know, I think I heard Woz tell this story where he went and bought like a handful of them out of this cookie jar at a trade show.
I've heard it enough where it must be true. Because I've heard it from several different directions that, yeah, they had 6502s in a jar. And I think they couldn't sell them at the actual show, so they had to get a room in the hotel, like off the show floor. Mm-hmm. And then you would go to the room, kind of like treating it like a hospitality suite or something like that.
Yeah.
So you have like a bowl of potato chips and a bowl of like Moss chips.
Right.
Don't mix those up. That's really awkward.
Okay. Let's see. So the next thing, these come up.
I almost picked this one.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. I almost picked that as one of my auctions. It looks so cool.
It's a microprocessor 1B, MPF 1B. And so what it is it's a little Z80 single board computer that's in the shape of a book. Actually, this is microprocessor. Who are they? They turned into somebody else. Acer, maybe? Yeah, anyway. But so I think this one actually is, I think, one of the real original ones. It's being sold for $190, buy it now, or make an offer, coming out of Alabama. But this seems like it's actually relatively complete looking. It's got the manual and it's got the keyboard overlay, and everything looks fairly clean. It has a power supply. It has several manuals, actually. So this is better than most of the ones I've seen, actually. So if you're looking for such a thing, this is a fairly good instance of it.
I love this thing. I've never seen these before. That form factor is amazing. That's really, really, really cool.
Yeah, it just sits on your shelf like a book.
So I guess to describe it for the podcast, it reminds me of, so some early software shipped in those boxes where it's like a plastic clamshell that opens like a book, and both sides are recessed maybe an inch. Or it's a little bit like a VHS case, except both halves have depth. What else came in packages like that? That's awesome. I love that. So it's got the manuals on one side, and then the computer perfectly fills the other half.
And the spine is sort of a standoff. Like it keeps them separate enough that they join.
That's
impressive.
Yeah. So these are pretty cool. You can still buy them, as it turns out. There's a company called Flight in the UK that still makes and sells these, and they had a an interview in this magazine, sort of talking to the person who is kind of currently involved in making them. So interview with Max D. Sulfa, managing director of Flight Electronics. And the thing about these, so Acer used to be Multitech, and Multitech is the creator of the Microprocessor. Yes. So that's the lineage. But Flight actually had bought the intellectual property rights to make these now. And they're actually fairly popular as like assembly or, you know, like machine language training. It's a very simple little processor, simple little interface. So schools will still buy them. And so they do still make small runs. It says somewhere that, you know, if you order them, you know, they're making runs of like 50 or something at a time. And as of June 2021, there were like 8 in stock or something, you know, so it could be a while before you get one, if you order one. But and I think somewhere in this article, yeah, there's a picture of the two of the original, like early Microprocessor 1B on the right of this two picture image, and then on the left is the Flight recreation. And so I think you can see the buttons, the button colors are the differentiating factor. So you can, if you could. You could look at an auction and see, like, you know, which kind you were looking at. And I think the auction we were looking at was an original one. But anyway, so that's kind of cool. And the highest power microprocessor was the 1P, the MPF 1P, which is a plus, I think, 1 plus, and it had more memory than the others, and it had more expansion capabilities. But this, I found one auction for a 1P, but it doesn't have like the book or whatever. It's just the board and the expansion stuff. So still interesting and complete, but what else? Oh yeah, I was going to mention this actually earlier when we were talking about the 99 4A. This is a Tomy Tutor. Do you guys know the Tomy Tutor at all?
It's basically a TI-99-4A. It has the Tomy Tutor. It has a different ROM set. I think, I don't recall if the BASIC is different, but it has the TMS-9900, and I believe it has the same, chipset as the 99-4A versus the 99-4. I can't recall what the level of compatibility is, but, and I don't think it was sold in the U.S. Was it overseas? But as I understand it, hardware-wise, it's almost the same.
Okay, yeah. Because I feel like I'd heard the name before, but I hadn't really understood what it was. But yeah, that does seem to be some kind of like TI-99-4A clone-ish.
Yeah, I know there's, you know, on some of the big TI sites, the TI, you know, user communities, there's often, you know, a page that has information. I'm almost certain, you know, it's not directly compatible. And I think there might even have been a way to, you know, like with that Sinclair that came to America. Like the 2068, to sort of do something with the ROM to make it actually, you know, actually compatible. I'm just remembering sort of vaguely, but yeah, you don't see them very often, I don't think. I mean, I think on eBay they're not super common, I believe. I don't think I've ever seen one on eBay.
Yeah, that's kind of why I thought it was sort of interesting, because it felt unfamiliar to me. But yeah, the Wikipedia article says it was sold in Japan as the Puta.
The Puta.
Sort of brief, shortened computer, I guess.
Yes.
But architecturally similar but not identical to the TI-99-4A.
Right. The current bid on the auction is $95. I'm guessing that will go up significantly, and that would be a very good price to acquire it if it were to stay there.
Yeah, it does seem like, it says reserve not met, so it does seem like that means the seller believes they have something here.
I mean, I think the build quality... It looks nice. I prefer it. It has the chiclet keyboard. I prefer the you know, I think I prefer the physicality of the TI, but it's certainly a very interesting, you know, very interesting item. It's kind of like the, I don't know if it's, if a close analog might be the Dragon computer,
yeah,
which, you know, it's very similar to a color computer, you know, but it's not exact, but I think it's very close. I mean, I think software may have had to do this or that to work on both, but everything runs on both, whether or not it's, you know, it, maybe it's a modification, but maybe that's a little closer than this.
I like the purple spacebar.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah.
It's nice looking. This reminds me of that. We've talked about there was that educational toy thing made in like the 90s that was actually an Apple II inside.
Right.
Yeah, the Tiger Learning Computer.
Yeah, the Tiger Learning Computer. That's right. Yeah. It's like shockingly late for the architecture.
Yeah. That was kind of a fascinating thing. Yeah, it does kind of look like that. It looks like some sort of, you know, something you'd see in like Space 1999 or something. Or, you know. 2001.
I think the TI-99-4, the non-A, had keys like this.
It had chiclet keys, yes.
Yeah. That's one of the ones that I always keep an eye out for, the 99-4. But I also know that, you know, whatever joy there is in a 99-4A, there is half that joy in a 99-4.
Yeah. The graphics chip is less, and yeah, no lowercase. And yeah, it's, but I mean, I guess it's more of a collector's item. I
did find at least one you know, set of pictures of the Tiger Learning Computer, which is from 1996.
Yeah,
and it had an Apple II inside. That's I think they stopped selling that Apple IIe in 1993.
Yeah, did VTech make this or no?
I don't know.
Well, I think Tiger was the name of the company. I think they were a similar company to VTech. They made educational electronics.
Yeah. And looking at the screenshot on the ad, it looks like I see that light blue. So I guess it supports double high res, which I guess it would if it's a, if it's like a 2E, 2C. That color is not available in high res.
Right. The Tiger Learning Computer itself looks like a little PowerBook or something, except it has the... It pretends like it has a screen, except the screen is really just cartridge storage, because, you know, you need to plug this into a separate screen. But it really does look like it's in a PowerBook case.
I would like one of these.
I think there are like four known ones. I mean,
I thought they were sold. I thought you could pick them up at any Best Buy or, you know, like Montgomery Ward's or something. Is it not like that?
I don't. Oh, I mean, not now. But even when they were new, I think they didn't. They must not have sold, or else everybody threw them away. Because
I see.
This is like a. It's a kind of a holy grail kind of item.
Oh wow! So you can't just pick one up on the cheap on eBay, I guess.
No, not only the only time you might be able to pick one up on the cheap is, you know, if you feel all right, you know, taking advantage of somebody who doesn't know what they have.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen it on eBay, actually.
Okay. I didn't realize that they were so rare and precious.
Yeah, it happens to hold the title of last Apple II to be produced. I guess that's probably true. There's a Sinclair ZX80, which is just sort of notable because there aren't often auctions for this. This one looks in as good a shape as any of them do. They were cheap computers, cheaply made, you know, and they all turned yellow and cracked. So it's, you know, this has a little bit of yellow and no obvious visible cracks. But
well, I think, do you notice anything unusual about that?
Should I?
I was just looking closely.
Should it be blue?
The ZX80.
Oh, yes, the keyboard's been replaced. It's got an 81 keyboard.
Yeah, so it looks like the I was going to say it looks like the ZX81, someone cut. I guess you'd have to cut that physically off the...
Yeah.
Or I guess it ends. I guess it's not part of the case on the ZX81, but yes, I'm almost certain that's a ZX81 keyboard.
Yeah, so the... ZX80 keyboard is supposed to look like this one on the manual.
Yeah, with the blue keys.
With blue keys.
Well, and the keyboard is crooked. Am I the only one seeing that?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, that makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
So this may have been like the North American import version or something?
I think someone had a broken keyboard and fixed it, because the ZX80 is much more desired than an 81, even though it's not as capable, I guess. Just like what Paul was saying about the 99 versus the 4A.
Yeah, yeah.
994 versus the 4A. Yeah, I'm guessing someone just tried to fix it by sacrificing an 81.
It might well have been fixed, you know, back in the, you know, 80s.
Yeah, long ago. Yeah. It would seem strange picturing someone, like, just to get it up on auction, like, doing repair work on this. I don't know. Somehow that seems humorous to me. Yes, I'm guessing this is, like, somebody that actually used it. Like, this was their... Yeah. Interesting.
One thing that just sort of struck me when I looked at this is it's got this, RF modulator, I guess is what that is, this box here, which reminded me of a total tangent that, you know, doesn't belong in this section anyway. But I've been watching this show called Bugs. Has any of you seen this before?
No.
It's a British program from 1995.
Yeah.
It's very funny because it's basically like the premise is it's sort of spies, private security, like PIs, I guess, in a sense. But they're technological, you know, they have lots of sort of hacker skills and listening devices and various things of that sort. But it's all the technology of 1995, you know. So they're doing their hacking on large pixel Windows displays, and at one point they were on an airplane, and the autopilot is being controlled from outside, and so they had the protagonist had to go in there and kind of like, you know, find the autopilot by pulling out a board. And thing that told them that it was the autopilot was that there was one of these little boxes on it. And I'm like, I know what that is, and that's not part of the autopilot. But at any rate.
Huh. No, I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah. I'm actually enjoying it, even though it is a goofy show. I mean, but it's funny to see the tech, and it's very non-serious. Okay, and then the last one is, this is just another random thing, but I thought it was interesting to see this set. This is expensive. This is a Panasonic HHC portable computer unit. They're asking $450. Buy it now. That's it. There's no offer. But what it is so it's this sort of calculator thing, the Panasonic HHC handheld computer, and it... You can normally get with that, you can get a little printer that you can plug onto the side. I have several of those because I think this has a 6502 in it. So at one point I thought, this would be interesting because I could talk to these. And so I was thinking I might try to program them at some point. But you could actually get a fairly extended expansion set. It's essentially like giving it slots. It's, the calculator goes into one slot and then it gets five extra slots. One of them is... has a serial interface, and one of them has a printer, and one has a sort of like a, I think it's like a chip reader, or maybe it's an EEPROM burner or something. But anyway, so I think it's kind of a neat set.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's worth that much money. I actually have most of what we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
I happened across it from someone who used to either do technical work or marketing work for Panasonic. So along with it, I got a bunch of, technical notes and documentation and software stuff. But it's a fascinating little unit. Again, though, when I got it, I just out of curiosity, I looked at some of the pricing for it and some of the doodads that connect to it. And it didn't seem like it was up that high. I know prices have gone up on retro computing equipment, but I don't know if they've gone up that much.
I think this little slot frame is expensive and rare.
Is that kind of rare?
Yeah.
Well, good to know.
Yeah.
Fully expanded.
The whole package is very nice looking. What's that top center thing above the I/O adapter? It
looks like a vertical slot. I was going to ask the same thing. To the left there.
This thing. Yeah, I don't know, actually. I have this. In fact, I have it in its box, but I don't know if I have the manual. I should look and see if I can find that, because somewhere I have a box of HHC stuff, and I think this is an interesting system. I wouldn't necessarily suggest buying this one for $450, but it would be neat to kind of get together with other people who own them and figure out what you could use them for. Anyway, okay, I think I will leave my auctions there, and we can move to closing discussions because it has been almost 3 hours. So let's see, Blake, do you have any closing thoughts?
I don't really have much to say in the way of closing thoughts. Yeah, just I've been doing a lot of, I've gotten back into it. Work is busy time lately, and but I've been taking some time in the evenings to catch up on the Telnet BBSing, which I enjoyed getting into a while ago, and I still enjoy it. It's been a nice thing to block out some time for. And there's some pretty interesting and relevant discussions, and you'd be surprised at how many, kind of how easy it is to get so far behind on posts that you're kind of hopelessly trying to catch up, which speaks well of, you know, people's interest and desire to use these things. Not everyone out there, of course, but there's a couple of boards that are quite active. So that's been fun, but I'll keep going with that, and yeah, that's it for me.
Excellent. Earl, any closing thoughts? Your internet has survived, it seems like.
I did. I made it through the whole show. No parting shots, other than just to say I'm glad we finally turned on all the bits, and I guess we'll see everybody in the Overflow episode.
Yeah, right. Let's see. I guess I'm next. I'm still digging around for these images of the HHC stuff. But so, Quinn, do you have any closing thoughts while I keep digging for these?
I do not, except so a couple of episodes ago, Michael brought up Night Serial, and everyone looked at him like he had three heads. So I just wanted to come in and stand up for Night Serial. It's a real thing of which I partake. And so, Michael, you are not crazy. Night Serial is real, and I am an avid consumer of it. That's all I got.
Oh, okay. What is night cereal?
Eating cereal at night.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Like in the evening as a snack, or if you wake up during the night, perhaps for a midnight snack, something like that. I got it from my mom. She did it as well, and it's usually like it's like dessert, basically, like you eat, kid cereal or something sweet at night.
Cool.
So there you go.
All right.
Much like the 68,000, I had listened to everyone agree incorrectly that it, no one would ever program an assembly, and that Night Serial was horsey talk, and both of those were incorrect. So I'm here to stand up for the 68,000 and for Michael.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, the 68,000 and Michael, thank you.
That's all I got.
We'll have to strategically slight some thing with which Quinn finds fondness occasionally, and that'll work out well.
That's how you get me on the show.
Yep.
Just say things I disagree with.
So, let's see. For me, I've recently been looking for pictures of my HHC stuff, but this I did find one specifically an expansion. It's a sort of a naked board that plugs into the side of the HHC and has a bunch of slots for the individual ROMs that you put in. A couple of these are filled, so you can sort of see what they look like. They have a little ROM and a carrier. A lot of these seem to be used by insurance companies and stuff. So, like, I have a bunch of ROM, ROM programs for this for, like, Forrester Universal Life and things like that, which I think is
interesting.
I think that's insurance and not a religion.
Interesting how many systems back then, like the PX8, the Model 100, it would take instead of cartridges or whatever, you'd actually just plug an app in and it would literally be like a dip chip. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that they didn't, get more electrical damage, because oftentimes they weren't protected at all. I guess that's an easy and quick way to interface to, ROMs for the company.
Well, and I think usually the plastic would keep keep the electronics, away from outer metal, except for the specific pins.
Yeah.
Right, like I think you could hold them without really touching the pins.
Okay. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I really should get out all the stuff that I have collected together a bunch of the units. I don't think I have all of them, but and just sort of try to make it do something. I don't think I have the acoustic coupler. I don't know. Maybe. But those are really annoying too, because like, what? How do you use that now?
Yeah, they're useless now.
Otherwise, yeah, I don't think there's not a whole lot going on. I'm still trying to scan stuff and get it uploaded, and things are going slowly. Anyway, all right. I think I can leave it there. So that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Review.